Hi, I'm Allison, and I'm anorexic from Vancouver.
Hi, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me to speak today. When I was first asked to speak, I thought a lot about the theme of the retreat, revive, renew, and recover, and kind of spent a lot of time ruminating on what that meant for me and what that brought up. And my thoughts kind of landed on something I'd recently been working with, which was Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I'm not sure if anyone's familiar, and I don't have a picture, but I figured it would make sense to explain it anyway for those listening that might not be familiar with it. It's a pyramid that this gentleman named Maslow developed to kind of explain human motivation and behavior. And so it's a pyramid with five different levels. And at the base, the widest and sort of foundational level is the physiological needs. So our need for food, our need for water, rest, warmth, that kind of thing, survival. The second level is safety, which is, you know, things like shelter, and but also like financial security, a stable environment, job security, that kind of thing. Our social needs are the third level, and that's like family, friends, a sense of belonging, and intimacy. And the fourth level is esteem, which is like that sort of sense of self-respect and prestige and confidence. And then the highest level is self-actualization, where, you know, you have your creative pursuits, you're innovating, you're, you know, really pushing for self-betterment kind of thing. And the premise of the theory is that each level has to be satisfied before proceeding to the next level. Sometimes there's a bit of an overlap, but for the most part, there's like our 12 steps, it's in order for a reason. And I also feel like the theme is sort of in its order for a reason too. Revive, renew, recover. And for me, I kind of added a why at the end of recover for recovery, because it's going to be an ongoing process. So I wanted to kind of frame my talk in those three stages and following that sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because it seemed to me like revive kind of encapsulates the first two levels, the physiological and the safety needs, and then the renew to me really looks at the social and the esteem part, that rebirth into life. And then a recovery was kind of where the self-actualization and the whole pyramid is coming together. So I thought I'd kind of frame my talk around that. So beginning with revive, I figured I'd start a little bit with my story. Not in too much detail because it's short time, but basically my home life growing up, we had like those first like three or four levels really, really taken care of for us. We were provided with all of the things we would need as kids and more. So basically we had the first three levels and we had the best shot at achieving the top two. We never had to worry about shortages, which is a gift, like a real gift. Very supportive home life. So like, where did things go awry was always a question, you know, that we've looked at in therapy all the time. And I've come to realize that I was insane long before I became anorexic. And I think that insanity was kind of ingrained at a genetic level. And while I had all of the ideal sort of nurturing growing up, nature won out in the end with that insanity. And so that manifested as fear. It's that center of the iceberg that we talk about. I had this fear of not being good enough, you know, not fitting in, being unlovable. And I didn't have that messaging coming from an outside source ever. It was just this internal fear that was the truth. So looking back now, it's really clear to me that so many of my decisions and my actions, even in early sobriety, just came out of those fears. And that's kind of sad to think about. Instead of a natural curiosity or a sense of adventure or desire, every decision from, you know, who my friends were and where I wanted to go to school and everything was out of fear. And so I remember I had a lot of high-achieving friends. My family, you know, I have high-achieving parents. I had high-achieving friends going through school. And one of them, he had this saying that has stuck with me for so long. And so he told me, life is what you make of it. And for a lot of people, I can see why that's really empowering. And for me, it was powerful, but it just became this idea that, you know, I have the power to make things go my way. And if things didn't go my way and turn out great, like, I was to blame because life is what I made of it. So I really took that into every part of my life. So hello, control freak, right? Like, hello, perfectionism. Hello, micromanaging. It was just, it just really, really, you know, fed into that insanity. So eventually, inevitably, in addition to the high achieving in school and being active in sort of sports and music and just wanting to, you know, that all that self-actualization stuff, it eventually landed on my body as well. And much like a lot of us experience, you know, at first it just really, really felt great, you know, feeling like I could do something that a lot of people struggled to do, you know, cutting out certain foods that people shared that they didn't have the willpower to avoid, and I did feel physically better for a while, and got compliments, but eventually, you know, it just took over, and I didn't like the person I was becoming, but it just, I still thought that it was making me more socially acceptable. I felt more comfortable and more confident around people. So I just clung to that feeling. And I really bought that idea that's so widely propagated today by diet culture and the health industries. And I'm not trying to place blame there, but I bought it that, you know, that idea that to live your best life, you have to absolutely control almost like every facet of your body, you know, whether it's exercise, rest, you know, food, all of that stuff. Like a machine, right? Like our bodies are machines. And what's interesting is the idea of my body as a machine really served me for a while, even though it wasn't sort of a conscious thing. But even into early recovery, you know, I looked at my body as this loaner vehicle, loaner like borrowed. And it helped for a while to treat my body with care. Because I would treat stuff I borrowed much better than my own belongings, for one thing. And you know, it made sense, you know, if you put the right fuel into your car and you get its oil change regularly and you have a good mechanic that you trust, you know, like your car will get you where you want to go. And, you know, you can always blame the manufacturer if it breaks down. And so, was really, really obsessed with sort of the clean fuel and, you know, the exercise. And what I have learned is that I effectively put my body in what you could call a crisis mode, because I was restricting, and forcing myself to exercise when I was exhausted and not sleeping, and also trying to, you know, get top grades and perform well in my, you know, in my sports teams and, you know, study music and all of these things. So while my body was in this crisis mode, which would only really naturally happen when there's a famine, you know, you think back to like caveman days, and if there's a famine, your body is in crisis mode, it's struggling to survive with very little food around. So what's it going to do? It's going to make you think about food all the time, so you're constantly hunting for it. If you get some of it, you're going to like get as much of it as you can, and you're going to hold on to as much energy as you can, so your systems start to really slow down. And I was fighting that all the time. I was fighting it. And, you know, like my body's sole job in a famine or in a crisis is, of course, to keep me alive. So my absolute need to control my food and restrict was effectively just putting me at war with my body, just at war with myself. You know, if you think about that kind of mechanism, that survival mechanism that our bodies have just naturally, you know, it's kind of like when you hold your breath for a really, really long time. And eventually, I mean, you're either going to pass out or you're going to like gasp for air. And I mean, that really helped frame the idea of kind of like the restrict, 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 and then binge cycle, you know, because of course, as soon as you finally get that air, you're like, and you take so much of it in. And that's natural. That's a survival mechanism. That's not like, you know, my body betraying me. It's trying to save my life. It knows how to survive a lot better than I do, but it took me years to realize that. So anorexia, I've discovered, is where my insanity has allowed me to override that body's natural intervention measure of forcing me to eat when all of my willpower is telling me not to. So, you know, most people eventually, you know, that's why so many people struggle with the idea of dieting is our body is actually fighting it every second, and eventually it intervenes. It says, no, like, you're eating now, like, we cannot go a second longer, feed me, you know? And the only, you know, chance of kind of overriding such a strong intervention measure is that insanity that I you know, was carrying with me for so long. That insanity of addiction, the addiction to that adrenaline high, you know, that our bodies give us to go and hunt for food when there's a famine. So I was addicted to that high, and you know, it's funny because when normal people are hungry, it makes them restless, irritable, and discontent. But like, I turned to restriction to get out of those things, you know, that was my escape measure. And to me, it just shows, like, of course, that's insane, you know, insanity, that fits me like a glove. So for so long, I chased that high. And again, I was at war with this body I was living in. And very recently, I had this change of perspective, and instead of thinking of my body as a car, I realized it was more like a noble steed, if you will, like a camel or a horse, that, you know, like an animal has a natural sense of what it needs, and it usually follows those instincts if it's allowed to. So when it's hungry, it's gonna want to find food, it's gonna eat. When it's thirsty, it's gonna drink water. When it's tired, it's gonna want to rest. You know, it doesn't like question that, you know, like we do as humans. So, you know, if I am riding this noble steed and I have a destination in mind, I kind of imagine the steed it kind of knows where it's going. And if I just let it kind of take me there, it will, you know, journey as much as it feels like it should in that day. It will sleep when it's time. It will eat when it's time, and it will get there in good health. But when I'm running the show, I'm like, no, we don't need to stop to eat. Keep going. We can make it before day, you know, daylight ends, and, you know, I'm pushing this poor animal until it's, you know, run ragged. And to me, the idea of that life, what I was putting myself through, thinking about it as like animal cruelty, like I think about like, I could never do that to another living thing. But I'm sitting, I'm lived in years of doing that to my own body. This creature that God gave me to just carry out a purpose on this planet. And instead of just treating it with love and compassion, like I would an animal, you know, I just tortured it. You know, I put it through this extreme level of restriction and just grueling exercise. And it just got to the point where that had just eaten up so much of my life, and every single thought from the moment I, like, before I even opened my eyes in the morning, I was thinking about, you know, how to control this life, building this house of cards, and that wasn't a life. It wasn't a life at all. And so eventually, just like every drug, that high just quit working for me. But only after I was hospitalized like several times and went through a gamut of therapeutic campaigns to like stop these crazy, insane thoughts and actions. And I just think of it now, I had this huge team of people supporting my recovery, and like I just was not on that team. I just was like not on that team. And you know, so it's no surprise that I couldn't show up for the important parts of my life. Like I couldn't, you know, I was dragging myself through high school, through university. I barely made it through, and I definitely didn't do it on my own terms. It was just, oh, it was awful. And the people, what I put people in my life through, I think one of the most painful sort of thoughts around that is just my sister who, you know, was faced with this stranger in her house, and didn't know how to relate to this person. And I remember just yelling and screaming at her because she could see right through me and my disease, and she would actively prevent me from acting out in it. She used to like walk really slow in front of me on staircases because she knew I'd run up and down them, and I would yell and scream, and it's, you know, thank God I never actually physically like pushed her out of the way, but oh my God. And the last few years of her life were the years like right before I got into ABA, and you know, like I was so ill, like even in the last few years, so like, struggling so much, and you know, I was unable to show up when she needed me most. You know, I couldn't even sit with her in hospital because I was so sick some days, and like, if you had to pick a reason to get out of an illness or stop doing something, like, that one's enough, you know? Like, my sister's dying, and I can't even sit with her. Like, that's just, oh, I carried that weight so long. So that's when I landed in hospital for the fifth time. Definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. So it's understandable that my parents were kind of just rolling their eyes. I'm thinking like, well, what's going to be different this time, right? They're pretty distraught at this point. And so the only change I could tell them that I could make was that I would go to this ABA meeting I'd heard about ages ago. And I had no idea what to expect, but I was in the hospital at the time, and this was like 1 hour's pass where I wasn't in the hospital. So I was like, well, okay, I'm going. So I crawled into the rooms of ABA on like a rainy Wednesday night. And I didn't know what to expect. But, you know, that's when I was just like on my knees at this level of inexpressible pain and desperation, you know, that I just can't even describe now. And I finally surrendered. Like I was in this place where I was willing to hear what was being said at these meetings. And my first thought was, oh my God, I'm in a book. Like, I'm not unique. This is like, I'm not this special, like, sunflower. This problem's just me. And it's like reading this, being like, what the? you know? Just like, okay. But then, you know, of course it meant that there was a solution that fit my problem that was written so clearly. And not just written, it was in the words of the people in the rooms, right? Like, that's why we're here. We get each other, you know? We really do. And I'd never had that before. Or if I did, it was, you know, we were all on the same page in terms of the problem, but there was no solution. You know, we could talk for ages about what we did with food and exercise, but there was no end in sight. But in ABA, there were these women who definitely spoke the language, but they weren't doing these things anymore. They had freedom, like that freedom. You could see it. You could hear it in the way they spoke and just that sense of centeredness they had and carried with them. They held their heads up, and I could never do that, and I wanted that. So miraculously, I finally, you know, continued to come to these meetings, and I finally had the willingness to get sober, to do what was told, do what was suggested. So the reviving began, you know. I was continued my hospitalization. I actually could, like, eat the food they were putting before me. Every other time, I had, like, fought the dietitian hard. My parents, like, were just so distraught. They just, like, allowed me to bring in my own dietitian to, like, you know, plan my meals for me. But even then, there was so much pushback. But this time, the dietitian was, like, in the hospital, was like, is this the same person? Because I sat down with her, and I was like, yeah, okay, you pick. Like, okay, you just decide. Sounds good, yeah. But she's like, oh, my God, what is this? So she's like, what medication did they put her on? She's like, okay. So I was like, it's the ABA pill. Take the ABA pill. So, yeah, and then after the hospital, I was discharged from hospital. My parents pulled me out of hospital the day my sister died, which was a good thing. And so I went home, and for the first time, actually was allowed my family to feed me, which, like, isn't suggested in the book. But that was my meal support at the time, and they were literally just doing what the dietitian had laid out from the hospital. And again, working this program and using the tools, like, I was actually willing to let them do that. And then, you know, my meal support came in the form of support with a family friend who I moved in with, because home was still really, really painful for me. That was really hard to surrender my home to get sober. Like, that was hard. And I moved in with a family friend, and she was a home ec teacher, so she was very, like, happy to cook and everything, but she loved having the help and the company of someone living there. So I was there with her, and I'm so grateful for her support, because with her support, she helped me discover, like, she'd be like, you know, we're eating dinner, but, like, you always just, like, struggle with meat so much, and, like, you don't get enough protein because you kind of push it around, and it's just so heartbreaking to watch you struggle. Like, you need this much protein, not this much meat. I'll never forget that, her hand. Just this much protein, not this much meat. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's when, like, soberly, I could become, with her guidance, I could go, you know, surrender the fact that, like, meat was just so hard my entire life. Like, even as young as 5, I remember my dad crying because I would, like, microwave steak because it was rare and I wanted it. Oh, it was awful. And so she helped me learn to be vegetarian, and then and safely. And, you know, I just took my guidance from her. I was willing. I got a sponsor who had what I wanted. She was amazing. And with her, I worked the steps. And I still didn't have any trust in my body, but I did have the blind trust in the fellowship. I had the willingness, thank God. And that's, you know, to me, Revive really encapsulates the steps 1 through 3, you know, that getting a relationship with, you know, admitting the problem, right? And starting a relationship with a higher power, accepting that if something bigger than me isn't in operation somewhere, like, I'm screwed. Like, I have no power over this disease. So then I sort of came to what I think of now as that renew stage. You know, which to me kind of is found in steps 4 to 9, where, you know, I'm kind of renewing my relationships with people around me and my commitment to my recovery and my relationship with my higher power, who I've always had. Like, I always had a faith, but what that looked like, I always had all these questions, and relating to it in the same way that my family did through Christianity was hard. I've come to a spirituality that's much more sort of cyclical. Prayer is a huge part. You know, through the renewal of steps 4 to 9, like, that's really strengthened. And asking God to remove my defects, making amends, like, that's the most intense renewal sort of process that I've ever kind of experienced in my life through anything. And it's totally changed me. You know, I could, as I was saying, you know, hold my head up for the first time and look people in the eye. And I still struggle with that sometimes. But, you know, at that time, one of the amends I made was to a boyfriend I'd had or tried to have in early recovery. And, before getting sober, and I just, like, it's just not sexy to have to drop your girlfriend off at the hospital on a, you know, on a Sunday night, you know, at the end of a weekend, because she just had weekend passes. Like, it's just not. And, like, who can relate to that? I can show up and be honest and be real. I just did not have the emotional availability. So I was making amends to him, and his remarks were just so, like, I'll carry them with me for so long. He basically said, like, you're this person, it's like everything that I was initially attracted to is, like, in full now. Like, he was just so struck, and not afraid to say it too. So I'm so grateful for him. And then I met the guy who is now my husband, which is amazing. Just, I won't tell the whole story, but, like, on the day I met him, I don't know why, I think I was, I'd been probably about 4 or 5 months sober at that point, very, like, into the honesty. And, you know, I just finished work, and he was hanging out at the cafe I was working at, so we were chit-chatting, and he sort of, like, was like, oh, what are you doing now? Like, do you want to hang out? And I was like, oh, I have a meeting to go to. I don't know why I said that. I could have said anything. I just have to go, you know? But no, I said, I have a meeting. I was like, what am I doing? And he said, oh, a meeting? Like, what kind of meeting? And I was like, oh, a 12-step meeting. What am I saying? I'm like, where's this honesty coming from? But okay, God. And he says, 12 steps. Is that like dance? And I was like, kind of. And so I ended up, I actually right there said, no, it was, I didn't have to get this honest, but right off the bat, I said, yeah, 12 steps, I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. The 12 steps are the only thing that's worked. It's kind of like AA, but for eating disorders. And I mean, like, I feel like a lot of other people would have been like, okay. But I mean, he was like, oh, that's good for you. That's awesome. So, and like I said, he's my husband now. So, and, you know, like, it's finally okay for me to be human when for so long, like, I just tried so hard not to be human, whether it was fighting my body, trying to show up for every single thing. You know, my parents are amazing people. They are so busy. They do so many things. But I've realized now that it wasn't about being busy. I tried to be so busy. And I'm still addicted to being busy. I have to let that go. But for them, like, I've noticed now in my recovery, they fill their lives with things that give them energy. It's this really good balance. Whereas before, everything in my life, you know, there was just this balance, you know, a lot of shoulds and energy output. And ABA gives me so much energy. I cannot stress enough the power of service work, which is where I think the recovery part comes in. Steps 10 to 12, working that daily inventory. You know, every night, like, I take some time, and I criticize myself a lot. I find myself thinking, it's not perfect. I'm not spending enough time with God. I need to really feel remorse for every single wrong I did today. But it's like, no, I just walk through in my brain. I'm like, God, you know, forgive me for the times today when I was judgmental, and I try and recall the times that I was, and I ask him for the grace to help me instead be loving and remove that need to compare myself to others, and forgive me for the times that I was dishonest, help me be truthful with neither fear nor favor, and I kind of go through that, and that really helps frame the next day. Like Amy mentioned, I'm so grateful to be a part of a committee that's just a really, really awesome part of ABA. I have three sponsees right now that just, they're such interesting people. And again, we speak the same language, right? And the meeting that we have in Vancouver, it's just such a gift to be able to show up in that. However it, God helps it grow. Being able to fall back on the tools. Like I rely on my husband when it's really hard. I don't turn to him when I feel fat, right? Like that's when I go and I pick up my phone and I text that message too, or I call, or I meet someone in person to really go through what's going on. But all I have to say to him is like, my brain is being mean to me. He knows what that means. It hurts him more to hear I'm fat because, like, he doesn't see that, right? But he knows what it means when I say, my brain's being mean to me. And he knows he doesn't have to fix it. He just gives me a hug. He says, what do you need? And sometimes it's like, I've cooked the meal. Please just plate it for me. To this day, if I'm struggling and it's hard, I just turn it right over. And I say, please just plate that meal for me. And he's good. And sometimes I'll be like, that's a lot of noodles. And he's like, okay. All right. He just looks at me like, yeah, isn't that great? And I'm like, that's right. Noodles are good. So it's good. Like, we can laugh about it, which is awesome. Honestly, the stuff of life really is those relationships and that sense of purpose that I get from my higher power. I don't have to know what my God's purpose is for me precisely on any given day. I just have to ask for the next right action. And that's, again, that's where that ongoing recovery is, that recovery work, that surrender, that, yeah, life can be so freaking hard sometimes, but, like, I don't have to go through it glamorously. I can kick and scream if I have to. And, in early sobriety, that sometimes meant I was, crying and tearing my hair out and, like, took me until midnight or later to eat my food. And I was exhausted the next day and I had to surrender that. But I did it one day at a time. Like, nobody says that you have to do this with all your makeup intact and the perfect outfit on. I'm in my PJs for everyone on the, because I needed that comfort to stand up here. Like, you don't have to do it, like, for the gram, we just show up the best we can every day. And, to this day, when those red flags pop up, like I was talking about yesterday, I just know I can go right back to this really solid foundation. I have what trust has turned into faith as a miracle of God's work through this program and through all of you guys. I know I can lean on you when I need to, and I love it when people call me because then I get a chance to realize, wow, like it's such a powerful program. Retreats like this are just, as Joan said, a real shot in the arm. I'm going to go home just... So I'm so grateful for this. This is what, recovery means to me. I'm not going to graduate from this program. I'm, God willing, going to be a part of it for the rest of my life. And that's a gift. That's not a burden. It is such a gift. And it's thanks to all of you guys for showing up on a daily basis. So thank you for my recovery. I'm so grateful to be here and to have had the opportunity to share. So please keep coming back. And thank you. Thank you.